Q&A time again. Let's talk about advisor succession plans, tax return filing statuses, and a few other tax return related items in this, the 87th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Okay, and we're back. Thank you as always for listening. We have another Q&A edition episode today. These are always fun. And today's overarching theme is going to be tax return related stuff. Partly because I got one really good question that's clearly specific to tax returns and filing tax returns. And then I also figured since it is, by the time you hear this, it is late February. So we are in the thick of tax return filing season. Many of you, most of you have all the documents you need to do your tax return if you haven't already. So I thought this was timely to answer some of these questions that some of them will come up for you, like especially filing status we're going to talk about. As far as the other ones may not be of relevance to you in your tax return, but still, I thought it was timely, so we're going to do it. I did get two questions sent in, again, one of which was about tax return filing status, which is going to be quite a lengthy answer, I think, and another one about advisor longevity, succession plans, which I'll touch on. As always, if you do have questions you'd like answered in this podcast, feel free to email me at andy@andypanko.com. I will try to get to them. I do have a couple others that came in that are super technical that it's going to take a lot of work and prep to answer. So one is around required minimum distributions from inherited IRAs and different recent changes regarding the Secure Act 2.0 legislation. And it's a really involved question that I frankly don't entirely know the answer to. So it's going to take some work. So I might do an episode entirely dedicated to that at some point. But again, it's going to be a lot of prep for me. So that one's kind of on the back burner for now, not because it's not important, just it will be a lot of effort. So let's get into it. But first, I wanted to let you know, I recently applied for a job hanging mirrors. It's something I can see myself doing. You know what I'm saying? How about that? Okay, moving on. Let us get to the questions, not waste too much time. I tend to always run on. I think this will be a relatively short episode, but here I am already jib-jabbering. So let's start. Both questions that were sent in are from Tom, two different Toms. So we'll call them Tom 1, Tom 2. Tom 1, here's a big one. So I will read what he sent. Let me see if I can remember. Okay. I have struggled to determine a few pieces related to my son filing taxes and when I have to stop claiming head of household status. So I'll you know what, before I get into the question, let me recap the statuses. I think this will be a better way to go about it. So I will get to the question, Tom. But when you file your tax return, in case you haven't noticed, there are five different statuses, filing statuses you can claim. Most of you listening are or were filing as single, or if you're married, most likely married filing jointly. That's the vast majority of all tax returns are filed under one of those. Now, there are some other ones, married filing separately, head of household, and what's now called qualifying survivor spouse. Prior to 2022, it was called qualifying widow or widower. I'll get into it. So let me recap these again. So the five are, again, single, married filing jointly, married filing separately, head of household, and qualifying survivor, a qualifying surviving spouse, formerly known as qualifying widow or widower. Let me start with the married ones. So if you are married, and this is as of the last day of the year, doesn't matter if you got married January 1st, December 31st, or any day during the year. Let's use 2023 as an example. If you are married as of December 31st, 2023, you can file, or you have to file, barring some exceptions, as married, one of the two married statuses for the entirety of the tax year. Again, even if you're only married one day, December 31st as of that year, you are considered married in the eyes of the IRS for the entirety of the year. So the first married filing status is married filing jointly. So generally speaking, if you're married, this is what you and your spouse are going to do. It's usually the most advantageous in terms of lowest ultimate tax bill for the two of you, but there's some exceptions and I'll touch on some of those. So married filing jointly has the largest standard deduction of all the tax return filing statuses and the largest or widest income brackets at which each tax bracket starts and stops. Now, for those of you who don't know what standard deduction means or tax brackets, apologize. I will discuss that at some point. I did do a video about how the federal income tax system works. I will post a link to that. for those of you to reference that. It's a super high level summary with visuals about how it works. But anyway, so I'm assuming a basic level of knowledge for purposes of today. So married filing jointly has the largest standard deductions and the largest or widest tax brackets. When you do file jointly, you are collectively, in the eyes of the IRS, you're viewed as one combined tax-paying unit. Even though you're two people, you're basically one party, one taxpayer. You, in effect, split and share all income reported on your return. So let's say you both have wages, you both have some interest, or maybe one of you only has one, doesn't matter. Point is, you collectively share that. You also share the tax obligations and responsibilities of your return. Doesn't matter who made the income. Maybe you made zero, your spouse made $500,000. You two collectively are responsible for the tax owed on that $500,000. If your spouse dies any point during the year, you can still file as married filing jointly for that year. So let's say you're married, spouse died, just picking a date, March 3rd. You can still file for that year, married filing jointly, even though you weren't married as of the end of the year, because your spouse died in March, you can still file married filing jointly for that year of death, not years beyond that. There's, again, some exceptions, but for years beyond that, assuming you don't remarry, you revert to having to file as single for years after the year of death. Again, subject to some exceptions, which I'll touch on. This is funky stuff. Okay, now, some of the exceptions are if your spouse dies and you have a child or another dependent, then you can claim, this is where the qualifying surviving spouse thing potentially comes in. And I'll touch on that because that is its own filing status. So that's married filing jointly. I'll stop there for now. And I should say, I'm going to have links in the notes to this show for some really helpful resources. One is see the IRS's instructions to Form 1040, where Form 1040 is a tax return. It's a thick, long document, but it spells all this out. That's a great reference. The IRS does have really good instructions and publications explaining things in plain English. So that's one of them. Another one, there's a website, a kind of guided question thing. It asks you questions, you answer, it steps you through. It says, what is my filing status? It could take up to a half hour to do, according to what the website says. But you plug in answers to all the questions and it'll tell you what your filing status is. So if you're not sure if you're married, filing jointly, married, filing separately, qualifying, surviving spouse, whatever, it can answer that for you if you put in the information. There's also another link, an IRS website, which is whom may I claim as a dependent? This gets complicated and technical. As I'll start talking through these other filing statuses, you'll see what I mean. Definitely refer to that that site, that link, that can, again, through guided questions, it can tell you, do you have any dependents you can claim? That then also helps help you figure out which one of these filing statuses can you claim. All right, so married filing jointly, we did. Next, married filing separately. This means you are still married as of December 31st of that year, but you choose to not file your tax return as a joint single tax-paying unit. You and your spouse separately, independently, file tax returns. Again, you're married, but you choose to file separate tax returns. Now, there's a lot of drawbacks with this. Generally speaking, it doesn't result, if you're married, it results in a less favorable tax bill or tax obligation for you. So more times than not, married folks are not going to want to file separate returns. You want to file jointly. So for example, if you do file separately, some credits are off the table for you. There's one called the earned income credit. There's education credits. If you were a dependent or in higher education, you're not eligible to take certain credits. If you have student loan interest you're paying, you do not get a deduction for that if you're married filing separately, but you can or may if you are married filing jointly. Also, if you're on Social Security, this gets complicated, but the formula that determines how much of your Social Security is potentially taxable is more punitive if you're married filing separately. Specifically, if you're married filing separately and you and your spouse live together even just one day throughout the year, you're automatically, your Social Security is taxed at the most punitive level versus if you're married filing joint, it could be taxed lower. The standard deductions if you're married filing separately are the same as if you file, as if you're truly single, unmarried. The tax brackets are a little different. They're more or less the same except for the highest brackets are the same. The lower few tax brackets are a little more generous if you're married filing separately as opposed to single. So when could it make sense to file separately? A few things. One example is if you and your spouse, you're married, one of you has large student loans. And the interest repayment on those student loans could be delayed or deferred based on income. If your income's low enough, you don't yet have to pay interest, or maybe the interest gets waived. If you file jointly, the lender will look to your joint income for purposes of determining if you're eligible to waive or delay the interest repayment. So maybe one of your spouses, you know, maybe the person with the loan, for example, only makes $20,000. The other spouse makes $500,000. If you file jointly, you are not getting an income-based waiver to the student loan interest. If you file separately and you have the loan and you only got $20,000 of income, then your income is only 20 grand. They're not going to look to your spouse's $500,000 of income. So you can then maybe defer or waive, get your interest waived on that loan. So that's one example where filing separately could make sense. Another one, this is a little technical, but if you have certain deductions, like large medical expenses, one spouse has large medical expenses, you may get a better chance of being able to deduct those on your return if you file separately, as opposed to if you file jointly, just the way that the math works with like medical expenses, for example, can only be deductible if they exceed 7.5% of your gross income. So the point is, doing this separately versus jointly could help you pay less tax. And when you blend that together with the two spouses, maybe in total, you two net out paying less tax than you did if you were filing jointly. There's no way to know this easily. Unfortunately, you kind of have to run through tax prep software both ways. Run it jointly and run it separately if you're married, and see which one produces the lower tax, in which case that then is how you know what may be more beneficial. Otherwise, just on the surface, it's really hard to know which one's going to be better. But again, generally, jointly is almost normally going to be the way to go for most people. Another time where you may want to do it, there could be certain state tax implications where you're better off if you file separately at the state level. But the state may say you can only file separately at the state level if you file separately at the federal level. So then again, you got to do the math. Even though you might be potentially worse off at the federal level filing separately, you may be better off at the state level filing separately, such that, you know, it nets out that between federal and state, you're better filing separately. I won't get into specific state things because every state has its own unique twists and turns, but hypothetically, this is a possible scenario where, you know, state tax reasons may drive your decision for how you choose to file if you're married. Another big one is you want to keep your tax liabilities and recourse separate. So recall I said if you're married filing joint, you two collectively are responsible for the tax obligations on that joint tax return. When you file separately, it's not the case. Spouse A is only responsible for the taxes, you know, due on spouse A's separate return. And same thing for spouse B. Spouse B is only responsible for taxes due on spouse B's return. So why would you do this? Well, if you don't trust your spouse, or, you know, if you think your spouse is going to do tax evasion or something, you don't want to be on the hook for it, then filing separately can remove you from being responsible for the other spouse's tax debts, or, you know, fines or potential jail time for tax evasion. When it's a joint return, you're both on the hook. When it's separately, you split it separately. And finally, I should step back a little bit. Certain states, community property states, of which I think there's 9, the rules could be slightly different. So I don't know the specifics, but I know enough to know to be dangerous. If you are in a community property state, simply filing separately, you know, married filing separate tax return may not completely shield you from your spouse's boneheadedness in tax evasion or having a large tax bill. So you got to look into that outside of this podcast. The other one where it may make sense is just simply autonomy over each other's tax returns. Like if you're, you know, your marriage is shaky and on the outs and you suspect you're going to get separated or divorced at some point, maybe you want to start just kind of running your books separately, not only for the segregation of liabilities where you're only responsible for each other's tax amounts, but just simply, I don't know, record keeping and sort of establish some precedent that yes, we are intending to go our separate ways, hence we're filing separate tax returns. So that could be another one. All right, so that's married filing separately. Now let's move on to the unmarried statuses. Again, there's 3: single, head of household, and qualifying surviving spouse. Single, fairly straightforward, other than the exceptions. So if you were never married, or you were legally separated or divorced according to your state law under a formal decree of divorce or separate maintenance, then you're single. So what does that mean? So never married is obvious. Never married, never had kids, for example, you are single. Maybe you can be head of household if you have a qualifying parent or other relative. We'll touch on that, but let's just assume you don't. You're single, pretty straightforward. if you were married during the year, but as of December 31st, again, it's the status as of December 31st that matters, you were legally divorced or legally separated under a formal executed divorce decree or separation maintenance agreement that's recognized in your state, then you are able to be single, or not able to be, but you are single as of December 31st, and hence you would file single on your tax return unless one of these other two things come into play. So these other two things, this is where it gets complicated. Head of household, this is a biggie. And this is what prompted, this was the genesis of the question from Tom, which I'll get to, but I figured let me explain it because there's a lot of moving parts here. Let me explain the background of head of household before I attempt to answer Tom's question. So what is head of household status? Okay, so you are single, you are legally divorced or separated, or, unique twist, you can be married and still be head of household, but you lived apart from your spouse for the last 6 months of the year, and there's a host of other rules you have to meet. Specifically, you need to have a dependent. Let's get into that. Well, before I do that, just a comment on head of household. The standard deduction is higher or better than that of a single filer, not quite as good as married filing joint. So it sits somewhere in between. As far as the tax brackets themselves, at the lower tax brackets, they're more favorable than single. Not as good as married, though. At the higher tax brackets, the points at which the income level start and stop are the same as single. So, you know, not better than single. I'll get into the details, but at a super high level, in order to be head of household, you have to have a dependent where you pay for more than half of the expenses of maintaining and running the household. And you're single, like I said, or haven't lived with your spouse for the last 6 months of the year. And you have a qualifying child or dependent. So let's get into that because this is where it gets hairy. And this is definitely where you want to use that IRS tool that says, what is it? And who qualifies as my dependent? That'll help step through it because there's a lot of pieces and if then, then this type conditions. But there's basically two, qualifying child or other qualifying dependent. So let's start with child. In many cases, this will be straightforward. Like you have a five-year-old kid living at home. Like, yes, this is a qualifying child, obviously. But there's more to it than that. So qualifying child is your biological or adopted child, stepchild, foster child, sibling, step-sibling, half-sibling, or a descendant of any one of these relatives. So like a grandchild, for example, would qualify because a grandchild is a child of your child. It's this descendant of one of these relatives. So that's a qualifying child. The child has to have lived with in your home for more than 6 months during the year. It doesn't need to be a continuous 6 months. Just, you know, you add together the days, it needs to be at least 6 months. The child needs to be younger than you. I mean, that's pretty obvious when it's your actual child. Just you can't have a kid that's older than you. But in the case of like sibling, remember I said sibling or step-sibling, sibling or half-sibling can qualify. This is where it matters. So if you have like a younger brother, younger sister, he or she can qualify potentially as a qualifying child here. At the end of the year, the child has to be under 19 if he or she is not a student, or under 24 if he or she is a full-time student, college student, or higher education. It doesn't need to be college. There's like some technical schools and I think some certain farm schoolings, but more or less this means higher education, under 24 and in higher education. Now, here's a qualifier. Note I said full-time student. Full-time means enrolled as a full-time student for at least 5 calendar months during the year. And this is going to come into Tom's question here. So enrolled as a full-time student at least 5 months for the year. So if you have a child in college who graduates in May, you know, graduates this year in the spring semester, that qualifies because January, February, March, April, May. Now, technically, they may be done with school, you know, whatever, mid-May. I'm fairly certain from what I can read and research, that qualifies. Even though the kid's not there the full 5 months, it's 5 months. Now, where it doesn't count from what I can see is if your child's only in school for the fall semester. That's only 4 months, September, October, November, December. Now, if the child starts in August, I'm not sure. Because if they do start in August, they probably don't start till late August. So like I said before, I think that would round out and be 5 months because you'd have August, September, October, November, December. So where I'm going with this is, as I think, even if your kid's only in school for one semester, they meet this 5 month test, unless your child truly is a fall semester and only starts technically some point in September, then it's only 4 months. So they wouldn't meet this test. So that's the other one. the education one, or the child did not pay for more than half of their living expenses during the year. The child did not pay for more than half of their living expenses during the year. This gets hard. You do need to keep records. You need to keep like spreadsheets when it comes down to actually counting who paid what in terms of maintenance and day-to-day living expenses. If it's not obvious, in many cases it is, you know, again, you got a five-year-old kid living at home. It's obvious. You're paying, the kid doesn't have a job. Kid's not going to the grocery store, but you got a 18-year-old in high school. Well, no, that's more straightforward, but you got a 21-year-old in college. May not be so clear, right? They're allowed to have a job. Having a job doesn't prevent them from being claimed as your dependent, but depending how much income they get and how much they're spending on themselves to support themselves, this can get hard figuring out who paid half of who. You know, did you at least pay half the kid's expenses? Yes or no? Many cases you probably still did, but it can start to get hairy, especially once your kids are, they get some significant income coming in from work. Another wrinkle: in some cases, you can still file head of household even if you are unable to claim your child as your dependent, specifically because you and your ex-spouse, you agree, you may be the custodial parent. Custodial parent means the child, even though you're divorced, the child lives with you most or more than half the year. You're the custodial parent. But you can sign a form. I forget what it is. It's like 83, 32 or something. There's an 8 and a 3 in there. I forget the rest. You can sign a form where you say, I, as a custodial parent, am agreeing to give up the right to claim my child as a dependent. I'm letting the non-custodial parent claim this child as a dependent on his or her tax return. So what does that mean? So you can't claim the child as a dependent, which means you're not eligible for like the child tax credit, for example, and you can't deduct the child's medical expenses on your tax return, but you can still file head of household using that kid as your dependent, even though that kid's not your dependent because you passed off the dependency to the other parent for the year. Super confusing, right? It is. So anyway, that's a wrinkle to head of household. Now, I should step back. Don't use this podcast as the definitive source of answering all your questions on this. This filing status thing, this dependency thing is really complicated. There's a lot of bespoke, unique twists and turns. Definitely use those IRS tools. Definitely, if you have a question, do reach out to a tax preparer where he or she, under a formal engagement of services, can do the work and figure out what is your tax return if you're not willing or able to do it yourself. This podcast is not the definitive source for this. I'm just trying to highlight most of the considerations you should have in mind here. All right, so that's a qualifying child, clear as mud, right? So what if it's not your child, or are there other ways that a relative, non-child relative, or other reasons under ways under which someone can still be a dependent for purposes of you claiming head of household? Yes, it's possible. For example, it could be your parents. You provide more than half the support for your parents. They can be a qualifying dependent, and they don't have to live with you either. They can live in their own house, but in effect, you're paying more than half the cost of the house. You can claim your parents as dependents. You can then potentially claim head of household with your parents as your dependents on your return. Okay, what if it's not parents? What if it's the same list of children that I mentioned, biological children, stepchildren, adopted children, siblings, descendants of any of these people, such as grandchildren, but they don't meet the age restriction, for example, because the kid's 26. Well, if they're permanently and totally disabled, they can still be a qualifying dependent. They have to live with you at least 6 months out of the year, and you have to pay more than half the cost of running the home. They can still be a qualifying dependent. Again, they're not young enough to be a qualifying child, but if they're permanently and totally disabled, they can still potentially be a qualifying dependent and qualify you for head of household status. Or they don't even need to be a child or a descendant of the child. They could be other relatives, step-parent, niece, nephew, a sibling of one of your parents, aunt and uncle, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, parent-in-law, brother-in-law, sister-in-law. If they lived with you at least half the year and you paid more than half the cost of maintaining the home, they can also be your qualifying dependent and qualify you for head of household status. Super confusing, I know. This is really something you kind of need to see visually in a flowchart, or honestly, again, the best way to go about it is stepping through that website that I'll provide that the IRS helps you figure out who's your dependents. So just to try to recap as cleanly as possible, in order to be head of household, you have to be single, legally divorced or separated, or you can be married so long as you did not live with your spouse at all for the last 6 months of the year, and you need a qualifying child as a dependent or a qualifying other dependent as a dependent. Then you can claim head of household. All right, let's move on from that. And the fifth status is qualifying surviving spouse. This used to be called qualifying widow or widower, but starting with the 2022 tax return, they changed it to qualifying surviving spouse. I guess to degenderize the terminology, I don't know, but it's the same thing, all said and done. So what does this mean? This is you were married, but your spouse died. Now recall I said in the year of your spouse's death, you can still file married filing joint for that year. That's still accurate, but you could potentially file qualifying surviving spouse for the 2 years after that year, 2 years after the year of death. So what are the qualifying conditions to do this? Well, your spouse has to have died, right? And then for the 2 years later, you can file as qualifying surviving spouse if you have a qualifying dependent. We're back to this dependent circle, messy bird's nest thing. If you have a qualifying child, or I think this is just child, actually, is it? Yeah. This does need to be child. This I don't believe this is those other dependents, like, you know, step cousins or whatever that list was I said before, you know, in-laws and stuff like that. They don't qualify. This is in effect just children. You have a children and your spouse died. You can be qualifying surviving spouse for 2 years after year of death. The benefits are this has the same standard deduction as married filing joint and the same tax brackets as married filing joint. In effect, you're still kind of doing married filing joint, sort of, which is a real benefit to this. Now, the child that qualifies you to get this needs to be your biological child, adopted child, or stepchild, not the other dependents, like I said. So siblings, parents, in-laws, whatever, will not qualify you for this. Your child needs to live with you all year in the home, not just a half year thing, except for temporary absences. So they're away at camp for 2 months in the summer, or, you know, they whatever, stay at friends some weekends here and there. That's fine. But they need to live with you for all intents and purposes the whole year. You have to pay more than half the cost of maintaining the house again. I mean, that's pretty obvious. So this, when you claim this, is pretty clear. If you have, you know, again, a five-year-old child, your spouse dies, it's obvious you qualify for that. I mean, maybe there's some exceptions, but generally speaking, it's obvious you qualify for this. Where it gets a little messy again is when it comes down to the age thing. I got to check. I don't remember. I think the age qualification for children might be the same as before, under 19 as of the end of the year, or under 24 if a full-time student. But I'll stop there. Again, there's more to dig into this beyond the scope of this podcast. But hopefully you found this helpful. I'm sure it was confusing as heck to a lot of you, especially those where you may potentially come into play some of these other filing statuses, such as head of household, because there are so many conditions and twists. But those are the five statuses. All right, so now bringing it back to Tom's question. Man, this is a lot of time already. Tom asks, my son is 22. It's his last semester in college as an undergrad. He graduates in May. My ex and I, so Tom is divorced. My ex and I split his college tuition and living expenses. When he's not in college, he lives with me. Per our divorce agreement, we alternate years. We claim him as a dependent. But since he lives with me when not at school and I pay for some of his other expenses, I've claimed head of household filing status. He'll likely go to grad school, but my ex and I likely won't pay for that. He probably makes about $5,000 a year in wages and maybe another $1,000 or so in capital gains, dividends, and interest. Questions. So Tom has four questions. Does he have to file his own tax return? No. So Tom is asking, you know, son's 22. He's older than 18, obviously, but still in school, but graduating in May. So Tom's not sure if he can still file head of household. And I just want to point out, he said he and his ex alternate years, they claim him as a dependent. Yet Tom was the one who filed head of household every year. This goes back to what I said before, custodial parent versus non-custodial parent. The custodial parent could pass off to the ex the ability to claim the child as a dependent, but the custodial parent can still claim head of household, even though in those alternating years, the child will not actually be a dependent on the head of household person's tax return. So Tom's question now is like, the kid's graduating halfway into the year and he's got some income. Can I still claim him as, you know, can I still claim head of household? So anyway, so Tom's question are, does the child have to file his own tax return? Probably should, but it's not required. The child doesn't have to file a tax return in order for you to claim head of household. But you said he has wages. If he has wages, he almost certainly had taxes withheld. Given his total income, which is only about $6,000, it's low enough that he's not going to have any tax obligation for the year because his total income is going to be below a standard deduction. So any taxes he had withheld, Tom, he's going to want to get back in refund. And the only way to get that refund is filing a tax return. So to answer your question, yes, he should file a tax return, but no, he doesn't have to do it for purposes of you claiming head of household. Question two, would him filing a tax return affect my ability to claim head of household? No. Again, whether he does or doesn't, does not impact you and your eligibility to claim head of household. It only impacts him. He's going to want to file a tax return to get a refund of any taxes he had withheld from that $5,000 of wages. Question three, what factors will determine if I can still file head of household 2024? So as I touched on, hopefully in listening to this, Tom, you realized what did or did not apply to you, specifically that 5-month thing. It sounds like your kid still qualifies for the education thing, even though he's over 18. He's under 24 and a full-time student because he was a full-time student for 5 months in this case, January, February, March, April, May. So the education thing still covers him for that purposes. What factors will determine if I can still file head of household in 2024? I think that was probably the big question you had. So far you still can. I think it's going to come down to, again, expenses. Without doing the ticking and tying and reconciliation of what exactly were his expenses, did he pay more than half his own support for the year? It sounds like he did not. How much did you pay versus how much did your ex pay is going to matter. To sum up briefly, his time at school doesn't count against you for, like, did he live with you half the year? I believe that's one of those temporary absences. And you said anytime he's not at school, he lives with you. So it sounds like he lived with you for 6 months out of the year. Sounds like you still pay for more than half the cost of your household. As far as his total expenses, this is where I'm not sure if technically you're still paying at least half. I know you said you and your spouse split the college, you and your ex split the college expenses. As far as his other expenses, I don't know how much are they, and does his $5,000 in wages cover it, or are you still paying, for all intents and purposes, all of his day-to-day living expenses? If you are, then I do believe you can still file head of household for him, but don't take this as specific advice or answer. I think it would be best if you go through that IRS question module and see what that says. But one of the questions is going to be, did he provide at least half his support? Depending how you answer that, that will ultimately dictate the answer of whether you can or cannot file head of household. And finally, your fourth question, any clear reference material on the subject that you'd recommend? Yes, what I mentioned before, the IRS instructions of Form 1040, which are linked in the notes, and that IRS website about who can I claim as a dependent. Those two are the best, most definitive sources I can think of. So that was Tom's first question. And then Tom has a second related, more of a comment than not a question, but he goes on to say, people talk about the tax hit when a spouse dies and the survivor has to start filing as single in the year after death or whatever the timing rule is. So yeah, it's like I mentioned before, if you're married filing joint, your spouse dies at any point during that year, you can still file joint that year. For years starting after that, you revert to single unless you remarry or unless you have one of these, dependents that you can give you another status. You want to say, but losing head of household status is also going to be a big hit. You lose a portion of the standard deduction and have increased tax rates for some income. This must affect a lot of single people who have kids graduating college. I rarely hear about this topic. You're right, Tom. It does. And like you're a prime example. Your kid eventually will age out of being able to be a head of household for you, or graduates out of school and therefore no longer qualifies, and you do lose the ability to claim him as a dependent, and therefore you lose the ability to claim him to claim yourself as head of household. 100% true. So it is an issue. Your taxes will get higher, all else equal, once you lose the head of household ability. It's not talked about a lot, but it definitely exists. So good comment. All right. I got a few other tax return related questions. These were things I found that I was either asked directly or were in the Facebook group and I thought were worth bringing up because, again, it's tax return time. Let me hit on those. Then I'll get to the other Tom's question about his sort of concerns or thoughts around small advisory firms and the longevity of those firms and what happens if and when the advisor moves on for whatever reason. So one question I got was regarding I-bonds. These were all the rage a couple of years ago when inflation spiked and interest on treasury I-bonds was high. Lots of people bought them. Now inflation went back down to normalized levels, and the interest currently paid on I-bonds has dropped a lot, especially for people that bought I-bonds a few years ago. So now, many people, or 2023, many people redeemed out of their I-bonds. The year you redeem them is the year you have to recognize and pay tax on the interest you got on those. So lots of people, or specifically anyone who redeemed I-bonds in 2023, needs to report that on your tax return. You need to get a 1099-INT, where INT stands for interest. You get that from treasurydirect.gov. They will not mail them to you. So if you don't proactively go on the website and get it, you're going to miss it. And you're not going to report it on your tax return. The IRS will likely catch it. They're going to send you a letter saying, hey, we noticed you did not report this interest. What's the deal? So if you did sell I-bonds during 2023, make sure you log on to your Treasury Direct account. And there's a few steps. I think it's, once you go there, there's like the Manage Direct link along the top. And then along the bottom left, it'll be like 2023 tax forms or something. And click in there. Now, what's annoying is when you do click on your 1099-INT, you're not able to download it. You can't save it to a PDF. You can print it like to paper, or through your computer, you can like print to PDF if you have that ability built into your computer, but you cannot, it won't download as a PDF that you can then save. You have to print it to a PDF or print it to paper. So don't forget to do those for those that redeemed I-bonds in 2023, because that will be taxable on your 2023 tax return. Another question, this was in the Facebook group. Here we are, February 2024. Can I still do a Roth conversion for 2023? The answer is no, the ship has sailed. Roth conversions can only happen in the calendar year that you want to report them. So, you know, here we are, February 2024. You cannot do a 2023 Roth conversion at this point. Where this question comes from, I suspect, and where it can be confusing, is that while you can't do a conversion for 2023 at this point, you can do a contribution to a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA for that matter, still for 2023, even though we're already in 2024. Specifically, you have up until the tax return filing deadline, so April 15th, unless it's a weekend or holiday and it's bumped out a little, you have until April 15th of the next year to do a Roth IRA or traditional IRA contribution for the prior year. Now, well, April 15th or whenever you file your tax return, whatever sooner technically. So if you file your return in March, you have to get the contribution in by March when you file your return. So why does the IRS give you a few months into the next year to do a contribution for the prior year? Well, because contributions to Roth IRAs or traditional IRAs are, in many or all cases, dependent on your income. And lots of times you don't know exactly what your income is for the year until you actually start doing your tax return and you get in all the forms for like your W-2 for wages and dividends and interest and whatever. Then you can go through the exercise and know exactly what your income was, and to the extent that phases you out completely or puts you in the awkward sort of phasing out range, you can then know precisely what the total amount of contribution is you're eligible to make, if any, to your Roth IRA. So that's why you have until now still, you know, early this year to still do a 2023 contribution, but not the case for conversions. All right, finally for this Q&A, a question from the other Tom. I will read what he sent. Nope, that's not it. Here it is. The other Tom asks, I'm glad you are back doing your podcast. I like the new format. Thank you, Tom. It's going well so far. I'd like to format myself. On this week's show, during the interview with Brian, so he's talking about Brian Tegmeyer, who episode aired second Thursday of February, the topic of selecting an advisor that isn't also about to retire came up. That got me thinking about the industry overall and if the industry is thinking about this potential problem. My hypothesis is that there are more and more solo or small RIA firms, where RIA stands for Registered Investment Advisor, trying to deliver service. If you assume the advisor is mid-40s now and the client base is early 60s, everything is good for the next 15 years or so. But what will all these small slash solo RIA firms do when the founder wants to retire? At that point, many of their clients will be in their early 80s and potentially not eager to start a new relationship. There are obviously strategies that could be done to transfer or sell the firm to another firm or take on a junior advisor and eventually sell that book to that person. I'm just curious if you see this as a potential issue, if people select a small RIA shop, and if anyone is talking about a handoff approach. Thanks for the input, Tom, AKA, I will call him the other Tom. Yeah, great question slash observation, Tom. And it is no doubt something that should be people should be aware of and take into consideration when selecting an advisor or an advisory firm to work with. So the industry as a whole, the advisory industry, is relatively aged. I forget the statistic, but I think according to those that have the CFP, Certified Financial Planner designation, there are more CFPs over 60 than there are under 30, or something along the lines like that. So as a whole, the majority of the advisors are quite aged. And it is a concern for what happens when these people eventually want to retire or pass or become, you know, unable to work for whatever reason. What happens to their clients? Now, when it's at a large firm, like, and I'm not recommending or saying you should or shouldn't use them, but like a Merrill Lynch, like a Morgan Stanley, like a whoever, like a Wells Fargo, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of people within the organizations that you can be handed off to, or, you know, succession plans. So there is a continuity there. That is one of the benefits of working at those large household name national places. Now, I would say, generally speaking, their service, their attention to detail, the closeness of relationship with their clients isn't as detailed, isn't as good, isn't as hands-on as it is with many of the smaller shops like myself, like Brian, like Larry when he was on the show in January. The larger places, generally speaking, are all about volume and production and having to grow for growth's sake. And they will have, you know, 100 plus clients, if not multiple hundreds, whereas small advisors, like you heard on my chat with Brian and Larry, we want like 50 clients each, and that's it. So super involved, provide much more, generally tax planning and income planning that the larger firms can't do, are specifically, you know, prohibited from doing. So anyway, so not to rant about that, but yes, at the larger places, there is obviously some built-in continuity. Even if they hand you off to some, you know, dolt of an advisor who doesn't know what they're doing, and the person's super green, and they're dropped 300 clients in their lap, you're not going to be impressed with the service. But nonetheless, it's better than like a complete cold stop. Like if you have an advisor who's a solo shop and he or she gets hit by a bus, it's over. Like there's zero continuity. Your accounts are safe. Your investment accounts are still at the custodian, be it Fidelity or Schwab or whoever. But the service, the advice, the guidance just flat out stops at that point, you know, if the solo person dies. Whereas if you're at a Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley or Wells Fargo, it doesn't. Again, you may not be impressed with who you get handed off to, but nonetheless, there's still some continuity on, you know, on day one. So that's one consideration. But yeah, smaller firms like myself, before I hired someone, and like, you know, Brian and Larry, who are solo shops, they both started, as did I, within the last few years. And we started as solos because we couldn't find a good model that we thought made sense, that we thought was comprehensive, that allowed charging the way we thought made sense at any of the larger places. So we kind of had to do it by ourselves. Now, the downside is we're doing it by ourselves. When you're starting day one as a new firm, you don't have a backup. You don't have another employee typically. It takes some time to establish your business, to get clients, to get enough revenue where you can now start taking on potentially an employee or a formalized succession plan or whatever. So you do run that risk. And that is a question everyone should ask if you are interviewing a solo or small firm. What happens if you die? Or what happens if you get sick? Or what happens if you choose or need to retire or something? And don't be surprised if the answer is, yeah, the relationship might stop. Or maybe they do have something more sort of formalized in place, such as what you started talking about, Tom. So my plan when I started was, you know, day one, it was just me, no more, and that's it. If I were to die, things end. But the plan was, as the business gets built and established, I realized there would need to be some continuity, and there's a lot of ways it can go. So I wasn't sure when I started what my intention would be. I thought at some point, maybe hire someone. That's ultimately what I've since done. So that, you know, is my answer. That's not the answer for everyone else necessarily. Or if not, find another firm that I like and trust and does things similar, and you know, level of service, similar fee structure, similar attention to detail with clients, that who operates the same way. And at least if nothing else, have referrals that I can give to my clients. Say, hey, if I die tomorrow, here's three people that I would trust for you to reach out to. They'll do right by you. Or, so it's not, at a minimum, that's what I did. Or another one could be, you know, eventually find another firm that, again, you jive with and operates the same way, to enter some sort of formal agreement, succession plan or buy-sell agreement. Whereas, you know, if I die, this person agrees to buy my business, step in the next day and, you know, take over. Clients don't have to stay. They may not ultimately like that person. Clients could leave, but nonetheless, there's someone to help, you know, the day-to-day continuity. So that's another option. I mean, I guess that sort of addresses it. So yeah, Tom, it is a risk. It is something people need to consider. There are ways it can be addressed, but for better or worse, you know, the big pro of these small and solo firms is they usually, in many cases, do things better, treat clients with more attention, more time, more robust services. But the downside is until their businesses get built up, if they get built up to the point that they really start to scale and expand, there is a risk of what happens if this person dies or becomes incapacitated. So ask that question, see what they say. If you're not comfortable with their answer, then that's not the right relationship for you. And maybe you should then consider a larger firm where there is other employees or some sort of formal continuity plan. All right, that was it. Thank you all for the questions as always. Hopefully you enjoyed this. I'm sorry the one about filing statuses and dependents got clunky, but there's no way to discuss that in a not clunky way, especially in a verbal format like that. Again, if you do have questions, send them to me, andy@andypanko.com. I'll be happy to try to answer them. If I don't, I'll take it personally. It just means I haven't gotten around to it yet, or it's a much bigger ordeal than me just sitting here riffing for a while. If you haven't already, please definitely take a moment to like and write a nice juicy review for this podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or whatever other platform you use to listen to it. If you haven't joined the Facebook group yet, do it. retirementplanningeducation.com. If you haven't checked out the YouTube channel yet, do it. Called Retirement Planning Education. And if you haven't checked out my company's newsletter, Retirement Planning Insights, definitely should. It is awesome. Comes out every month, 7 a.m. Eastern sharp, first of the month. Lots of good stuff in there. All right, that's that. I'm done. I'm parched. My voice is starting to crack. I will wrap it there, and I will see you next time. Thanks as always for listening.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.